Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we look back at some of the best interviews and stories we featured in 2008. We'll have an interview with the curators of the Black Velvet Painting Museum, a chat with B-movie queen Tora Sitana, star of Faster Pussycat's Kill Kill, and we'll hear recordings from the 1908 presidential campaign. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. One of the more unusual things we came across in 2008 was a new take on the classic umbrella design. Inventor Alan Kaufman was tired of his umbrella turning inside out during storms and wind gusts. What he came up with was something that looks like a plastic bubble you wear over your head. He calls it the Newbrella, and he hopes it will change the way people think about umbrellas. I talked with Kaufman back in March and asked him to describe the Newbrella and explain what makes it so different than the standard umbrella.
Well, it differs probably in a bunch of ways. I think that the major flaw with the traditional umbrella, as most people know, is the problem with wind and the fact that they invert and they're very difficult to manage in the wind. So the first distinguish is that this thing is designed aerodynamically, where the wind flows over and around this canopy with an extended material down in front, so it completely denies the opportunity for it to invert.
Well, describe it for us. What does it look like?
It's kind of like an oval design. Almost think of like a bicycle helmet that's extended with longer sides. So it's kind of oval, where the canopy kind of goes down to about your shoulders on the front, back, and sides. So, think of it as like a little cutting into the wind where there's no flat surface that much for the wind to kind of hit.
Umbrella technology really hasn't changed in hundreds, probably thousands of years. Why change it now? What was your inspiration for this?
There was no inspiration, I'll be honest with you. I was in New York City in my prior business in one of my wireless stores, and it was a miserable, miserable rainy day outside one day, and I was just looking outdoors and watching people as they struggled with their umbrellas, and out of nowhere, this image just came to me. I never planned on it, nothing, and I just decided to jot down that image because I thought it was kind of unique. And that was it. Put it away for about a month and then decided to pick it up and see what I had there and pursue it.
Talk a little bit more about this hands-free umbrella and the technology used to make it happen.
The hands-free kind of came later down the road as the design. We take the pole out of the middle, which is another distinguishing point, because you want to be in the middle. That's where the maximum coverage is. So with an offset handle in the front, we needed to stabilize the kind of the weight of the, even though it's very light. So we had these shoulder supports that just rest on your shoulder and you hold it in the front. And if you let it go, it would rest on your kind of like your stomach and it could be hands-free. But then I said, I want to get this completely hands-free where it really won't move. So we developed another strap that goes from the back to the front that's optional, that goes under your arm, so it completely locks it in. You don't even really feel it, and now it's a complete hands-free umbrella that could even be hands-free in 30-mile-an-hour winds.
Well, in your press release, you talk about the retro look of the Newbrella. It does have a very mod look to it. What was the inspiration for that, or was it intentional?
I don't think so. Again, it just goes back to creating an aerodynamic product that, like any other product that deals with the wind, they kind of have this aerodynamic look. And then with the clear plastic, it kind of goes back to the retro of maybe you remember the bubble umbrella in the 60s, and I think that's where we're picking up on the retro kind of look to it.
Now, also in your press release, you talk about the, quote, the suggested impact of global warming has caused consumers to desire better products when facing forceful storms, chilling cold, and severe weather conditions, end quote. You kind of implied that the Newbrella is the first step in a more advanced weather protection system. Now, are we going to be walking around in giant bubbles someday?
Well, I think it's unique that the only weather protection device that we really have out there is an umbrella. And if you think about the umbrella, it really doesn't protect you against all the elements. For instance, cold weather. And we don't walk around in ski masks anymore and how bitter cold it can get, but people still suffer with no real protection. This device actually steps further than just participation and offers some protection against cold weather and wind. So I think it's more of a technological device that's going to offer more weather protection than just the umbrella.
It's a rather large device. How big is it exactly, and how does it compare to, you know, regular umbrellas, size-wise?
It's not as actually big in terms of width and everything. It's probably a slight smaller on the size, which is great for the busy sidewalks of, like, Manhattan, where you don't have to do the bobbing effect. So it's more streamlined.
So how does it compare to other umbrellas?
Well, if you compare it to a mini umbrella, you know, the small, there's two sizes of umbrellas, what I consider the mini and the so-called golf. It's certainly adequate, if not better, than the mini umbrella in terms of the size and the protection it will provide you. Certainly a golf umbrella is going to provide a little bit bigger canopy that will offer a little bit more protection, but then you have the complications of when wind is around and the size of it, and it's pretty difficult to manage when the wind does get a hold of it. So I think this is almost like taking the umbrella, like I've said, almost into the 21st century, where it needed to be kind of evolved to the umbrella. It's never really evolved.
You mentioned a second ago golf umbrellas, the big golf umbrellas. Are you expecting people to play golf or sports wearing the new umbrella?
Well, I don't think you physically could hit some balls with it, but I don't think anybody would ever play golf in it unless they wanted to chip and putt in the rain. But, it's really not designed for that. I think more for sports enthusiasts, it will be a major spectator item. You could, when you're sitting watching a sports outdoors, you have to hold your arm up in the air for an hour and a half or 2 hours. Here you can stand completely hands-free, drink a cup of coffee, or talk on the phone, actually. I really see it being a real viable solution for sporting stadiums. As you watch football games and blizzards and everything, umbrellas are barred in stadiums. And we feel this could be a product that solves that problem, where you could take it into stadiums. It wouldn't affect the people around you. And more importantly, it has no sharp points that cause injury. And that's why umbrellas are barred in stadiums.
Now, I assume you field tested the new umbrella. What sorts of reactions do you get from people when they see this on the street and people walking around wearing this?
There is no doubt that almost every set of eyes will look at you. It's just a different device, as you see, and everyone's going to look at you. I have worn it in New York many, many times, and most of the reaction I get is, "That's cool." That's probably the number one phrase that I get from people. That's what they'll say, is, "That's cool."
Who is the new umbrella aimed at? What's your target audience?
I think it's a wide audience at the end of the day. Originally, because it was designed for wind, we think of the big metropolitan cities because they deal with the skyscrapers that cause much more wind tunnels. But now we're seeing, even in rural America, anyone that's housewives that are going to a soccer game to watch their kids play in the snow, it's a product that you can stand hands-free and keep warmer. So I think the fact of the warmer and the hands-free brings in so many more elements. You can actually ride a bike with this completely hands-free, and it works excellent. And maybe not in this country, but a lot of people in other countries don't own cars, and they commute to and from school, work on bikes, and this is a perfect solution for them.
When I was looking at pictures of the new umbrella, it's made for a single person. And there's a certain romance about sharing an umbrella with someone. There's been songs written about it, stories written about it. Do you feel the new umbrella loses some of that romance?
I would say yes, to that extent. But I've always saw my product as almost a new line item to the world, where everybody that owned my product would also own a basic, what I call, mini umbrella for the regular light rain days. My product may be a little overkill for that day. Who knows? So those may be the romantic days, but when it gets pretty miserable out, I don't think people are going to be too concerned with, romance when the conditions get pretty harsh.
Are you thinking about a new umbrella built for two?
It's a possibility. We've actually have some photographs with two in there, and I certainly see other variations of this product coming. We're certainly going to do a children's product that we've had huge demand for because of the safety factor, taking away all the sharp points. But I definitely see this product evolving further. We've even had people ask if they could put speakers in there to play their iPod. So I see it definitely evolving.
That was Alan Kaufman, inventor of the Nubrella. We first talked back in March. This is Sidetrack. Of course, one of the biggest stories in 2008 was the presidential campaign and the election of Barack Obama. With all the sound bites and videos from the election, it's hard to imagine an age with no campaign sound whatsoever. In November, Jeff Bossert looked at the first efforts 100 years ago to pair up the views of presidential candidates through the recorded word.
William Jennings Bryan and William Howard Taft never debated one another. But in 1908, one Nickelodeon operator in New York City at least tried to give that illusion with the help of wax cylinder recordings. Richard Martin is the co-founder of Archaeophone Records.
You've got the two mannequins, right? One is Bryan, one is Taft, and then the machine is playing the cylinder, and then you play the other guy's cylinder, so you've got this idea of a debate. These were apparently pretty popular, and there's art from the period depicting it with great amusement.
In fact, it wasn't until 1960 when John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon appeared on network TV did two U.S. presidential candidates exchange views in the same room. But if Bryan had completely had his way, things may have been different.
An Ideal Republic by William Jennings Bryan, Edison Records. I can conceive of a national destiny surpassing the glories of the present and the past. A destiny which meets the responsibilities of today and measures up to the possibilities.
In 1908, about 15 years after Thomas Edison's wax cylinder phonograph made its way from the experimental stage to the nickel slot machines, Bryan, a Democrat, made the first commercially recorded campaign speech by a presidential candidate. An Ideal Republic was lifted from his acceptance speech from the 1900 Democratic Convention. It's one of 22 speeches by Bryan and Taft that's now part of Debate 08, a CD put out by Archaeophone. The Champaign-based label specializes in reviving recordings made between the late 1880s and early 1920s and packaging them with extensive booklets, putting them in historical context. Archaeophone is releasing a complete set of the two-minute speeches for the first time. The earliest Edison wax cylinders in the 1890s were used for a wide variety of recordings, songs, band music, even comedy monologues. But some found an ethical dilemma that came with the new concept of preserving speech. Patrick Feaster is a professor of folklore at Indiana University who wrote album notes for Debate 08.
What are the limits and what you can really do with that? What's proper? For instance, if you record a preacher doing a wedding ceremony, can you use that cylinder then to marry people? So, you know, using a phonograph to do political speaking for somebody was something that took a little getting used to. People weren't quite sure what they thought of that.
Feaster says running for an office with the dignity of president also seemed beneath not only recording speeches, but traveling around the country to make public appearances. William Jennings Bryan was one candidate who attempted to break from that mold. In his 1896 campaign, the man known as the Great Commoner embarked on the first whistle-stop train tour by a presidential candidate. And the recording industry decided to play a role in the campaigns of Bryan and Republican opponent William McKinley. But the cylinders made available to the public weren't the candidates' voices. They were recorded by actors, complete with staged cheering and applause. But Patrick Feaster says its listeners were more concerned with entertainment than politics.
So the idea of a reenactment of a historical episode may have seemed to them a little bit more like a Hollywood movie today, the reenacting something from the Civil War. It wasn't really that they were fooling anybody by passing off speeches, you know, that were actually done by actors, and yet it's supposed to be McKinley or some other candidate. And it was really more about giving people a particular kind of experience. You could sort of imagine that you were there listening to a speech.
And at first, there were technical limits to making a wax cylinder recording. Phonograph companies had yet to perfect a way of copying them, meaning musicians and voice actors had to spend hours in front of the device making duplicates, something presidential candidates would hardly have time to do. The recordings were again faked in 1900 when President McKinley faced Bryan for a second time. And for the next few years, when Bryan chose not to run, candidates like Theodore Roosevelt were unwilling to stoop to making a recorded address. But things changed 8 years later. Technology finally allowed for easy copying. Bryan was back in the race. All it took now is for William Howard Taft to consent to the same thing, which he finally did to avoid any perceived advantage by his opponent.
The Democratic platform recommends a tax upon national banks and upon such state banks as may come in the nature of enforced insurance, to raise a guarantee fund to pay the depositors of any bank which fails. The proposition is to tax the honest and prudent banker to make up for the dishonesty and the imprudence of others. No one can foresee the burden which under this system...
Taft's address, entitled Enforced Insurance of Bank Deposits, is one of 12 speeches by the Republican contained in Debate 08 to accompany 10 by Bryan. David Giovannone, an audio historian and one of the CD's producers, says it's odd how prevalent issues like international affairs and financial security are still taking up presidential debates 100 years later.
Taft, the Republican, is saying, look, you forced the banks to pay insurance on their deposits, and what you're going to get is lawlessness. You're going to have a lot of bankers speculating with money, and they don't have anything to lose, because if they lose, they have an insurance fund that'll pay their depositors, the government will step in. You know, that's not what the Republican Party wants to see. That's a pretty damn interesting story right now.
Other speech titles that highlight the CD's 45 minutes include The Philippines, The Rights of Labor, The Popular Election of Senators, and Rights and Progress of the Negro. The cylinders cost 35 cents each, the equivalent of $8 today, and while many would gather in one home to listen to them, Patrick Feaster says it appears people were still caught up in the novelty of the recordings and not so influenced by the message.
We generally assume they did not sell well because there just aren't many copies of them around today, and a record that sold really well, you expect to turn up a lot of antique shops and the like. I suppose it's also possible people just pitched them after the election is out of date. But the effect on the campaign is a bit of a mystery. Nobody, as far as I know, has really come up with a good answer to that one.
For Bryan to have been so taken with the idea of wax cylinder recordings, it would appear the campaign tactic didn't work. He suffered the worst of his three defeats in the race for president in 1908. David Giovannone, who spent decades compiling the set of recordings by Taft and Bryan, says it would be presumptive to assume the Edison Phonograph Company was trying to preserve the voices of great men.
They were just trying to make a buck, as, you know, with anything they recorded. Now, you will see some poetry about, you know, having the voice of the next president, no matter who that may be, on an Edison cylinder that they wrote that summer and fall. But it was a commercial operation.
But that commercial outfit that appeared to have only passing interest 100 years ago is being treasured today. I'm Jeff Bossert.
For more info on Debate 08, visit archaeophone.com. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Black velvet paintings featuring unicorns, disco-era nudes, and, of course, Elvis, have never really been accepted by the art world. And husband and wife team Carl Baldwin and Karen Anderson think that's a shame. They are fans and obsessive collectors of black velvet paintings. In fact, they run a black velvet painting museum where they live in Portland, Oregon, called the Velveteria. Last summer, they put out a book about their favorite black velvet paintings called Black Velvet Masterpieces. It's from Chronicle Books. I talked with Baldwin and Anderson in April and asked them what they were featuring at the Velveteria.
Our current show is called Unicornucopia, which we have features the unicorn comb-over, which if you saw the book, you know. The woman who's the mane of the unicorn is envelops a woman's head, and they look like they're almost conjoined by the actual hair. And it's very, very interesting. People have stood in front of that and had like a moment of pause in their life to reflect on that painting. It's very touching.
Well, unicorns are a big motif in black velvet paintings.
Yeah, they are. A lot of rainbows, too.
In the 80s, unicorns eclipsed Elvis as the most popular theme in velvet painting.
Well, I definitely want to talk about velvet Elvises in a bit, but first tell me, like, how do people react when they enter your museum and see these walls and walls of black velvet paintings?
I think they're pleasantly surprised. First, they're overwhelmed. I would say overwhelmed is the first word because there's so many of them, and there's no place anywhere like it where there's so many paintings because they're just salon style. They're just, the walls are covered with them. We have, you know, them in sections, but they're just, sometimes there's a gasp or just a, whoa, you know.
They're overwhelmed and usually speechless, and there's a lot of jaws being dropped.
So how many paintings do you guys currently own?
Oh, gosh. We just got two just now.
So what's that, 1,824?
I don't know.
Wow.
I'd say over 1,600, 1,700.
That's a lot of black velvet paintings.
It is.
How did this all come to be?
Carl, I'll let you know.
Well, we started out, we grew up in Los Angeles, and we saw people selling them on street corners. And, even though I never really bought one when I was a kid, I don't think my mother would have allowed it in the house, they always stood out in our minds. And then we found one in a thrift store down in Bisbee, Arizona, and it was a woman with a blue afro, and we picked it up and thought, whatever happened to these? And then we began our search on the Velvet Trail, which is continuing to this day.
That was in 1999 that we got the first one.
So why black velvet? What is it about the material that draws you to it? And why do you think it's better in your minds than regular canvas?
Partly because it was cheaper, you know, to collect these. But it's so, some of the paintings are so enigmatic. The lighting, it's like Carl says, it's almost, regular paintings look kind of bland in comparison. And the subject matter, some of it's hilarious, and some of them are really beautiful. And
yeah, it spans everything I say from pathos to whimsy in a frame. And when you look at the really nice ones, they pop out. They have a 3D effect, and because of the map of the velvet, and it just makes it pop out. And also, like animals on velvet, because of the map of the velvet and the hair of the horse or the dog, makes animals look very realistic. In fact, there's one artist named Bert Tyree who did some phenomenal paintings of marmosets and
bush babies,
and a koala bear that looks so lifelike, it looks like you could pet it.
Earlier we talked about one of the most famous subjects for black velvet paintings, that would be Elvis Presley. How many Elvis paintings do you guys own, and why do you think Elvis is the archetype for this genre of artwork?
Well, how many do we own? Maybe 20?
I don't know. I was just telling Karen, we've got another wall we had made, and I thought, why don't we just do an Elvis wall and get all of our Elvises? So we're probably going to be looking for all of them, counting up today. But I'd say, I'd say possibly 20 or...
Why he was the archetype.
And why?
You know, in Mexico, when people died and they were famous, then they'd get painted on velvet, and they just... After Elvis died, they just went completely nuts painting Elvises. They just turned them out. And I think that might be why, because there were so many, and he was such an icon, and people loved him. And I don't really know why. That's sort of the one thing people mention, but there's so many others. You know, now the longer we're into it, we realize that That's one thing people think of.
And actually, Jesus was on velvet painting before Elvis.
And more
often than Elvis.
Now, black velvet paintings have always got short shrift from the art community, big A art community. They've always kind of looked down on black velvet paintings. Why do you think that is, and is that deserved?
No,
it's not deserved. Actually, velvet painting is hard to do, and I still can't figure that out. I think they're just snobs. I think it's probably ignorance. To give you a serious answer, they just don't know about it. And people think, especially nowadays, I think automatically, oh, velvet Elvis, and you know, maybe or a matador or a
crying children,
or a Pink Panther or something, or unicorns, and they just dismiss it. But, well, we have an art critic here in town who will not come in, and he is just afraid of the velvet. I think it's kind of like holding up a cross to Dracula, holding up a velvet painting to an art critic.
We don't get it, really. I mean, I don't know. It's a phenomenon. It crosses so many. There's just so many different subject matter and the different countries. I mean, it's an all-inclusive art form, and I don't understand their problem with it.
It's a worldwide phenomenon. It's the painting, probably that sold more paintings on black velvet than anything else, except maybe paint by numbers, which would really give the heart attack to the art critics.
Well, there was a show at the Smithsonian. So.
Yeah, it was a paint by number show at the Smithsonian. We're waiting for a call from the Smithsonian for the velvet.
Well, the thing that I find really, really interesting when I go through the gallery in the back of the book where you just kind of show all these different types of paintings is that the black velvet paintings are very much in the moment, whether that moment is, you know, the 1970s or the 1980s. But they are very tapped into popular culture because I'm looking at some of the stuff you have, you know, Michael Jackson and Oprah Winfrey and modern stuff, Mr. T, And it says it seems very tapped into a particular place in time and a cultural snapshot. Do you guys get that feel?
Oh, totally.
Definitely. It's it is the heroes and of our time that got on velvet. And yeah, like all the musical stars.
Yeah.
And then like also Martin Luther King and Malcolm X were.
Kennedy.
And the Kennedy. John Kennedy was very big on velvet. Anybody who died young and tragic, Princess Diana is on velvet. But yeah, it is like a snapshot of the 60s or early 70s. Looking at some of these rock and roll ones, because we have, you know, everything from, you know, Kiss, Alice Cooper, Frank Zappa.
I did Bo Diddley, but didn't get in the book.
She didn't put Bo Diddley in the book. Stevie Wonder and even Snoop Dogg today.
Well, some of those we had commissioned, like Oprah Winfrey and a few, and oh, what was the other one? James Brown. But most of them have been out there and really popular. Who's really popular? Well, we have a number of Willie Nelson, and we've never seen Dolly Parton or
Kenny Rogers.
Rogers is big on velvet, but we've never seen Dolly Parton, and we'd love to have her on velvet, and we haven't seen Johnny Cash on velvet. Either they're keeping them or. Who knows?
Yeah, people are holding on.
We don't understand because it's almost like you've reached some kind of a pinnacle if you get on velvet. I mean, there's something out there that you would be painted on velvet and basically coming out of Mexico, because they would look at our culture and what sold. And if it sold really well, they'd keep making them.
Right. Whoever was popular got on velvet. And then we find the oddball things, like we found Dr. Kevorkian, which was pretty weird to find. I think he was just a one of a kind.
And we have Engelbert Humperdinck.
Yeah,
and
we found Engelbert Humperdinck.
And that's like a one of a kind.
Yeah.
So if somebody like me is looking for these black velvet masterpieces, I don't even know where to start. I mean, you don't go to an art gallery. Thrift stores, sure. But where else?
Well, we get them at estate sales, thrift stores. You know, we've been fortunate since we opened the museum that people have come to us. And we did buy a huge collection of more than a couple hundred paintings, and they were really high quality. People donate them. They call us. Where else did we get them, Carl? eBay. You can get them on eBay. Some of them are pretty bad.
Flea market. You still see one occasionally. But we just took a trip down to San Francisco, and we only found two. We found a Chevy Impala.
Which we love.
64 Impala, and then we found Quintal McGraw. So it's kind of slim pickings.
I think people are collecting them again. I know they are in Portland. They've gone up quite a bit in price. But they're out there. In fact, we heard they're more out there in the Midwest than here. Everything's gotten so picked over out west.
Yeah, somebody told me they're falling off the trees out there.
Well, every once in a while, you'll still find somebody with their van parked up on an empty street lot or, you know,
wow,
empty corner parking lot and sell them all the back of the van. But that is few and far between. But every once in a while, you'll see that.
I keep hearing that, but I almost think it's a mirage,
it.
You know.
Or it's those blankets, you know, those blankets. But they do that here, but they don't sell felt paintings. But I would not be at all surprised if it comes back.
Well, if people want to find out more about your collection of black velvet paintings and about the Velveteria, where can they go to?
It's velveteria.com, and it mainly talks about... just shows a few pictures and how to get to us, and it shows some of our links and shows we've been on, and then the book's coming out soon, and that'll really give you a great representation of velvet painting all over the world, actually.
And in the book, we have the history of velvet painting. We have a chapter on how to paint a velvet masterpiece. So we include everything in the book.
I mean, we really wanted to give credit to all the velvet painters because
they're the unsung heroes of the art world, because it is a technically difficult thing to paint on velvet, and what these guys did is really beautiful work.
That was Carl Baldwin and Karen Anderson, who run the Velveteria Museum in Portland, Oregon. Their book, Black Velvet Masterpieces, is published by Chronicle Books. Still to come, an interview with cult movie icon Tura Sutana. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. Anyone who lived during World War II will have their own set of memories from that time. Even childhood memories can be very vivid and specific. For one Central Illinois woman, wartime memories evoke her father's work with a community that most Americans regarded at the time with fear and suspicion. From the May episode, Jim Meadows tells us more.
In the mid-1940s, when Carolyn Wilbur was a very little girl, she lived in a house on Grand Avenue in Des Moines, Iowa. It was a big house with several rooms, perhaps more than she and her parents needed. But the Wilburs did not live there alone.
My felt sense was I was the only little blondie in a sea of dark hairs. And I lived in the house, a big house, with many other people, all of whom were Oriental. And I very quickly picked up the ways, the foods, and so on.
The other people living in the house with Carolyn were Japanese Americans from the West Coast. They had been forced to leave their homes after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and stay in special camps in remote areas. They were among an estimated 120,000 Japanese Americans that the government had incarcerated during the war because they considered them security risks. But even before the war ended, some were being allowed to resettle away from the West Coast. Misericordia University professor Alan Austin has written about the Japanese American experience during World War II. He says that to help with the resettlement, the Federal War Relocation Authority looked to outside groups.
Certainly when Japanese Americans get out of the camps, they leave with virtually nothing but the clothes on their back. They need to find housing. They have a job lined up, but they need to sort of connect to a community. And so hostels provide, from the WRA's point of view, sort of a buffer or a way to help these former inmates transition back into civilian life.
That's where Carolyn's parents came in. Ross and Libby Wilbur ran the Des Moines Hostel for the American Friends Service Committee. Carolyn says her mother ran day-to-day operations while her father helped Japanese Americans find jobs and housing in their new communities.
This was an unpopular job, as you can imagine. He described one man threatening to throw him off his porch when he was looking for housing in a certain area and said, "There ain't gonna be any Japs in my area."
Decades later, the U.S. government would apologize for the Japanese American internment and pay reparations. But in the wake of Pearl Harbor, most Americans in the 1940s saw nothing to apologize for. Roger Daniels is a retired professor and an expert on immigrant history.
The incarceration of Japanese Americans was a very popular wartime event. All the data we have indicates an overwhelming number of Americans supported it and would have supported even more severe action.
The Japanese American families staying with the Wilbers came and went. Carolyn remembers a young man with polio who her mother treated with hot blankets. Then there was an elderly woman who in her younger years had arranged flowers for the Japanese emperor. And there was a teenager named Roy Kita. Roy was a Nisei, a second-generation Japanese American, born and raised in California. But he had spent the last 2 years at a Japanese American internment camp in Wyoming.
There were 10,000 of us living in this, what they call, relocation center, which we said were America's concentration camps, because we were within barbed wires, and they had high towers with military guard with machine guns pointing toward us to make sure that we stayed within the camps.
Roy's father had died before the war. Her mother had taken his ashes to Japan for burial, but was unable to leave once the war started. Roy was incarcerated with his sister, two cousins, and his uncle, who had raised him since his father's death. Together, they all came to the hostel at Des Moines. Roy remembers little Carolyn Wilbur from that time, but he remembers her father, Ross Wilbur, more vividly.
Ross made it as happy as it could be. We're trying to adjust to a new life after coming out of the camp, and he was trying to find jobs and permanent housing for everyone, and we shared in the domestic chores. For instance, I had to stoke the furnace and feed the coal in the furnace. He had to teach me how to do that because I was from California.
Ross Wilbur had taken on a job that few Americans wanted or supported. But as a conscientious objector, Wilbur was used to unpopular positions. His daughter Carolyn says her parents' work with Japanese Americans at the hostel was a reflection of their faith.
It was very important to my parents, to my dad, to put the faith into practice. Quakers talk about faith and practice. And out of the faith needs to come the practice, and the practice of loving other human beings, treating them well, treating them with respect and regard, all these things. And it was very important to him to do that.
Roy Kita lived at the Des Moines Hostel for only a few months. After that, he worked as a live-in houseboy. By the time he graduated from high school, the war was over, and Kita, once considered a security risk, enlisted in the Navy. He wrangled an assignment in Japan so he could help his mother return to the U.S. While there, he met his future wife, Yuri, a Japanese-American from Seattle, who had also been through the internment camps. Yuri says she initially resisted when a friend tried to fix her up with a sailor.
And I did not want meeting a sailor because in Seattle, only bad girls went out with sailors. And when the fleet was in, there was a song that said, "Lock up your sisters, the fleet's in." And when I did meet him, it was Roy.
After a stint in the Navy, Roy Kita returned to Des Moines, enrolled at Iowa State, and in 1952 married Yuri. And he kept in touch with Ross Wilbur. Years later, when Roy was on the East Coast working for RCA and Ross was also out east with Lutheran Social Services, they and their families would visit frequently. Roy says Ross was a grandfather figure for his children.
When he retired from the Lutheran organization, he sent me an invitation, and I wrote to all the hostel alumni, and they sent me a letter, and I compiled a book of letters, and I presented it to him at his retirement, and none of his colleagues at the Lutheran organization knew that he was a director of the American Friends Hostel, and I was glad to tell everybody this part of his life because it was a great service to the country.
That was in 1977. Today, Ross's daughter Carolyn, now Carolyn Treadway, lives in Normal. Roy Keita is retired and living in South Carolina. Both Ross and Libby Wilbur passed away years ago. But Carolyn still has the book of letters Roy put together. It's a book Carolyn says was very important to his father. Here she reads the letter from Roy Keita.
Dear Ross, I was the most fortunate of all the hostel alumni. I had the good fortune of living with you during relocation days, plus 7 years of close relationship with you. And
today, the United States is caught up in a different war. Both Carolyn Treadway and Roy Keita say they hope today's Arab Americans never have to go through what Japanese Americans went through in World War II. But they both keep fond memories of Ross Wilbur, whose willingness to go against the grain helped many Japanese Americans during the war.
We were grateful that we could always lean on you in times of crisis. We Nisei do not have the flair of expressing our feelings to others, but knowing we named our son Kevin Ross Keita shows our love and admiration for you. Gratefully, Roy K. Keita.
I'm Jim Meadows.
This is Sidetrack.
Your old man's been blasted out of his wheels, and your king-sized brother's been twisted like a pretzel. You're all that's left, lover, and you ain't gonna be around for long.
I don't believe it.
You better believe it.
A clip from the end of Russ Meyer's cult classic, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, featuring Tura Satana as the powerful and deadly Varla. Satana is best known for that role, but she also starred in other cult films like Astro Zombies and The Doll Squad, as well as appearing on many popular 1960s television shows. Back in July, I talked with Satana about her life, her cult status, her soon-to-be-published life story, and her relationship with Elvis Presley. I asked her to start with a 10-second synopsis of Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Faster Pussycat Kill Kill is about three go-go dancers who take a trip into the desert. I wind up killing somebody and going in search of an old man's money that he got as a settlement, and wind up killing everybody basically on the ranch except for two people.
It actually is much more fun than you make it out to be.
Of course it is.
40 years on, you know, people are still talking about this movie, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. You are a cult movie icon, no doubt about it. How does that feel? I mean, you can't deny that.
Well, I never really thought about it. You know, I know that when I first did the film, I did it basically tongue in cheek, where I wanted to get rid of a lot of anger, and that film helped me do that.
Well, nowadays, there are comic books about you and your character Varla from Faster Pussycat. I've seen lunchboxes, Faster Pussycat lunchboxes, and now
yep.
There's a statue coming out. Is that all a bit surreal to you?
Well, yeah. Why did they wait so long? It's one of the things I want to know. But no, the lunch boxes, yeah, they're definitely out there, and as for the statue, it was the artist who came to me and he said I saw your performance in Faster Pussycat Kill. He said I just have to do a figure of you, and I said, oh well, okay.
Well, going back to when you actually made the movie, what was it like working with Russ Meyer and the rest of the cast?
Well, working with Russ was not difficult at all because he was very easygoing when it came to dialogue. He knew what he wanted camera-wise, and he set if something set well with him, he would shoot it in different angles and stuff like that. But some of the dialogue was from about the 1940s, 1950s, and it was not something that that girls of that day or that era would use. So we were able to ad-lib and got a couple of nice lines in there. And the weird part about it is that as far as Russ and I were concerned, we stayed friends for all the years that he lived until he passed away. He always used to tell me, you know, that it was just the two of us that made that movie. Oh, really? I says, what happened to the other people? And he says, well, they were superficial.
Well, when you think about that character, Varla, she is very much a superhero. You know, have you ever thought about it in that way? Because she's a very powerful character, and I know an inspiration to a lot of people, especially women.
That's what surprised me a little bit was the fact that Varla became such an icon for women, and a lot of battered women. Because I used to get emails all the time from battered women who said, I saw your performance in Faster Pussycat, and you have changed my life. They say, I realize that I don't have to be ashamed because I've got big boobs. And I don't have to be ashamed because, you know, I'm not a carpet to walk on. And I said, no, honey, you're not. What you have to be, I said, is strong, first of all. Know what you want, go get it. And once you get it, keep it.
Well, I think one of the reasons that role resonates with people, because it's very honest, and it seems to have grown sort of organically from you as a person, and reading through your life story, what there is out there, it's very easy to understand how you brought your own history into that role. And, you know, the rough life you lived, growing up in Chicago, and the girl gangs you got involved with. Talk a little bit about that experience growing up.
Well, basically, I had to toughen up because the neighborhood they moved us into was a gangster neighborhood, basically. You know, and they moved us into a housing project.
And they moved you in from a Japanese
internment camp.
Yeah, internment camp.
Yeah. Yeah, from Manzanar. Anyway, they put us there, and we went to, I think it was a Jane Addams Housing Project. I think that's the name of it now, but I don't know if it's still there or not. It's in Chicago. And I went to a Jacob A. Riis Grammar School. When I went to school, I used to have to, because I looked different than all of them, because I was not black, I wasn't Italian, I wasn't blonde and Jewish. I was Oriental, and I had black hair, slanted eyes, you know. So I used to have to fight my way to and from school every day. So my dad started teaching me some of the martial arts, some Aikido to help some of that along. But then there was a black girl gang that used to gang up on me when I'd be heading home because they wanted me to do their homework for them because I was just, you know, like a superior student. it was one of those things where I had to learn. I had to learn to be tough. I had to learn to stand up for myself. And I had to learn to roll with the punches as far as being called Tojo's daughter and cheeky, cheeky Chinaman and stuff like that. The racial slurs and the stuff like that, they hurt, but I never let them know it, you know. So it was just one way of being able to cope with life in general. And when I got a little older, after I spent a little time in juvenile hall because I got raped by five guys, I wound up just basically touring my neighborhood with a bunch of other girls that became my friends, because they knew if they became my friends, nobody would pick on them, because no longer did anybody pick on me. We did our little gang, our little girl gang thing, and with our boots and our leather coats and watching the neighborhood so that nobody else got raped and nobody else got hurt.
So let me ask you this. How much of Varla Wheelie was you, and how much of it was the total opposite of you?
I would say about 75% of Varla was me, and the other 25% would have been the fact that I'm really a pussycat until you rile my temper, and then I'm no longer a pussycat. Prior to that, I'm supposedly, I guess, one of the nicest people I know.
Well, that is actually true, because when I met you, I was actually kind of taken aback by how un-Varla-like you really are in real life.
Yes, that's the one part that always astounds me. People expect me to be just exactly like Varla, but Varla was a character, you know, and I put a lot of me into her. But she was still a character. I am a very caring person. I love my friends, and I'm very faithful to them and very loyal to them. Any of them ever got hurt or anything like that, I would be right there for them. Varla wouldn't. Varla would have gone off. She'd gone off on her own. Said,
well,
oh,
she put a knife into one of her friend's back in the movie.
Yes.
Now, you are currently working on your biography, correct?
Yes.
And do you have a date when that will be published?
Hopefully it'll be by the end of this year.
Oh, so it's going to be coming out pretty soon.
It should, yeah. The only thing I'm adding to it right now is pictures. They're doing the editing on it, and then I'm adding photos from my life, various stages of it.
So what sorts of things will we be reading about in your biography? Anything you can disclose for us?
Oh, basically you're going to be learning about my girl gang and how I got started basically in the film industry. I'm also writing my life as a stripper.
Which was a big part of your early career, was as a burlesque performer.
Yeah, I figured I'd do that differently than the one for the film, because I feel that there's a lot of misunderstanding, is the only word I can think of. When strippers were in my era, we were taught to be graceful. We were taught to be enticing. We were taught to be a tease. We were taught to be a tease. You know, and to titillate the customers, but do it with class. That's one of the things I want to put in there also.
Well, you aren't shy in your MySpace page and on your website talking about some of the famous men you've known, including Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
And this story amazes me. You say that he actually asked you to marry him.
Yes.
And you said no.
Right.
Well, tell me more.
Oh, well, if I'd have married him when he asked me to marry him, his career would have been blown so far out into outer space that it had never come back. Yeah, and I could not see him blowing his career just, you know, to marry me.
And at the time, you were still a burlesque dancer, right?
Right. I was still a stripper, and back then, strippers were not classified as very nice ladies. That was one of the things that the colonel really was ticked off about. He kept telling me that he could change me into a singer, and I said, why? And he says, because. He says, you've got a great voice. He says, but. He says, you've got a great body, too. And I said, I already know about the body. And I did. I used to sing quite often when I was younger. I was the school soloist, and I was, you know, I started out as a singer and then found out that I could make more money taking my clothes off.
Also, you talk about, after you said no to Elvis, he went on to marry Priscilla Presley, but in his own way, he didn't forget you. Tell me a little bit about how that took shape.
Have you seen Priscilla Presley's pictures when they first started going
together? Oh, absolutely.
Who does she look like?
Well, according to your story, Elvis made her to look like you.
Yes, and he put stage makeup on her, you know, when it was totally unnecessary. She's a gorgeous lady. She didn't need that, you know. But he tried to make her look like me. When he knew me, and I was dancing on stage. I always wore heavy makeup then, but you know, like I never wore it out in public. I used to tell him, you have to stop this. And he says, why? And I says, because. I said, you're not letting her be herself. I said, you're trying to make her into me. He says, but he told me, he says that that's what he wanted, you know. And I said, that's not fair. That's not fair to her. I guess eventually he gave up on it because she started changing.
Well, do you ever regret not marrying Elvis?
Yes, I do, because I think if I had married him, he'd still be alive.
Well, you're still very active, working on all sorts of projects. As we talked about earlier, the statue that's being made of you. You go to these conventions. You're writing your biography. Is there anything else for you to do? Is there anything else you want to do?
Yeah, we're going to make little doll. We're going to make dolls of Varla.
Action figures?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
And a little, see what we can come up with.
That was Tura Sutana, star of the cult classic film Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. You can find her online at turasatana.com and on MySpace at myspace.com/tsatana. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. All the past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL Urbana.